So, in some ways, of course, it's very hard using language. What do we really mean by real, by love? By a word like balance, which doesn't seem to have much place in our normal notions of love and falling in love and love makes the world go round and all of that. In some ways, I think the trajectory of understanding a deeper sense of love or loving kindness really follows the trajectory of faith in the Buddhist tradition. So faith doesn't mean adherence to dogma or subscribing to a set of beliefs. The literal translation of the word sadda, S-A-D-D-A-H-A, in Pali, that's usually translated as faith, is to offer one's heart. It's to give over one's heart to someone, to something. That's the meaning of faith. And it needs to be aligned with wisdom. It needs to be aligned with self-respect. The first realization is that one has a heart and that it's worth something when we offer it. And the trajectory, I found an interesting one. So the first phase or stage of faith is called bright faith. And that is likened to falling in love. So the example is given of, it's like you feel like you're in this room and it's really like cramped and dark and enclosed, the door's closed. And then something happens that the door swings open. And you don't know what's out there, but you know it's so much bigger. And there's so much more possibility. And life just seems so much bigger. It's a very amazing, intoxicating, extraordinary state where suddenly the world gets blown open. My favorite example of that actually came from being in Cleveland for a conference, and Betty and I, who's here, Betty and I snuck out of the conference, went to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and we went to the Bruce Springsteen exhibit in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and on the front of the glass was the letter Bruce Springsteen wrote upon the occasion of Bob Dylan getting inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So what Bob Dylan wrote was about the first time he, what Bruce Springsteen wrote was about the first time he'd ever heard Bob Dylan's music. So he was, I think, I found out later he was like 15, I can't remember how old he was, something like that. And he was riding in a car with his mother, and one of Bob Dylan's songs came over the radio. And Bruce Springsteen said, it was like a giant boot came down and kicked open the door of my mind. And he said, and then my mother said, that man can't sing. So it's not like everybody has the same response, but that's that sense of like, whoa, this is amazing. Life is so full, it's so rich, it's so incredible, right? So that's the sense of bright faith, and it's amazing, it's important, and from the point of view of the Buddhist teaching, it's really just the beginning. It's kind of immature, because first of all, it's not grounded in ourselves, right? Maybe we meet a certain teacher one day, and that's what elicits the sense. And then we meet another teacher another day, and all of a sudden they're the flavor of the moment. And it's like, forget that other guy, I'm following this one, or whatever it might be. So it's not very grounded in us. And then the biggest problem with it is that because it seems to be owned by or provided by someone else, whether it's a place or a person or a situation, it seems to be provided by something outside of ourselves, we get afraid to rock the boat, right? You don't want to do anything that might threaten your proximity to what seems to be the source of this extraordinary state for you. So that's where people in a spiritual scene will start to be afraid to ask questions or point out things they're uneasy about because you don't want to risk it, right? You're counting on this, whatever, to provide you this extraordinary experience. And I think the parallels with love are very strong. I wrote about when I went to Burma, Upandita came to Barry in 1984 and 1985, I went to Burma to practice with him. And that's the first place where I did intensive loving kindness practice as a method for 3 months. And it was somewhere in there that I had this experience. And like many experiences, I think it doesn't sound that intense in words, but it was a big shift for me. It was something like realizing that prior to that experience, I had seen love as something in the hands of someone else, and they could give it to me or not. You know, so it was almost like a package that the UPS delivery person was going to give to me, and then I'd have love in my life. And if they got to my doorstep and decided it was going somewhere else, they were gone. And then I would not have love in my life. And then I realized, bless you, I realized it is not that way, that it is an ability, it's a capacity, it's something within me, and other people may awaken it or nourish it or threaten it or whatever. But it actually is within me. It is this capacity within me, right? And so that's the kind of corollary. So with faith, the maturing of faith goes from that kind of super intoxicated feeling to something that is more grounded within oneself because you've questioned, you've tested, you've wondered, you've put things into practice, you've seen for yourself what's true or not. And that's considered a good process. It's not the same process as being afraid to rock the boat or question anything. And that kind of grounding the sense of what's true within yourself is a really essential step. And then in terms of that movement of faith, there's so that's going from bright faith to what's called verified faith. And verified faith deepens until the things that we are, things we really value, the things we offer our heart to, it becomes so in us that it's not something we hold as a belief, it's not something we are self-conscious about. We just really walk the talk. We have become something. So my favorite example of that these days really is the Dalai Lama, who seems, as far as I can tell, to not be adopting a persona in any situation. I've seen him, I was just talking about this to somebody for some reason, because I've just seen him in a lot of situations, of course, formally in talk, but occasionally, coincidentally, we've stayed in the same hotel, you know, and I've seen him with the entire staff of the hotel, gardeners, maids, everybody lining up to say goodbye to him. And he just goes down one by one and blesses people. And I've seen him, so this is what we were talking about, my friends and I the other day. We were staying in the same hotel, and I went down the elevator, and I was sort of very near a side door, and there was a group of Tibetans waiting there. And I realized, oh, he must be leaving through this door. And so I ran and got my friends, and we're all standing there, and he came out, so maybe there were 15 people there. He said, you know, goodbye to everybody, and he walked out the door. And then the friend I was with turned to me and said, wasn't it amazing that he said, practice well? And I said, that's not what he said. And then someone else came up to me and said, wasn't that fantastic to hear him say whatever? And I said, that's not what he said. You know, every one of us had heard a completely different thing. It was really very interesting. You know, but it was never, I just never get a sense of like, well, you're not important enough to hold my interest. I think I'll hurry past you to get to the governor or somebody. You know, like, it feels like he is embodying that sense of the power of love, and it doesn't feel artificial. You know, like he's giving himself a lecture that he's saying, well, I am the Dalai Lama, so even you're the most boring crowd I've ever met, you know, like, I better act like I care, you know. It just doesn't feel like that. So that's actually considered the third stage of faith, where the things we trust, the things we value, are so in us that we just live them. So I think there are parallels to this evolution of love. Interestingly enough, when we do formal loving kindness practice, as we'll do in a few minutes, the first recipient is said to be ourselves. Because, remember, this is like a practice of generosity. It may be material generosity, or it may just be offering our energy, our time, smiling at somebody, looking at them instead of looking through them, right? It's like a generosity of the spirit. And we look to material generosity because it's often a good example. You know, it's that much more concrete. So we look for it to understand different dimensions and different challenges. So it's said in the Buddhist teaching that the best kind of generosity comes from a sense of inner abundance, or at least sufficiency. There has to be some sense of wholeness, or something else will likely come into the generosity. Sense of feeling coerced or compelled, or everyone's looking at me, or, you know, I have to do this, some sense of obligation, or whatever it might be. So I think we see that just in life, where somebody may have very little by external standards, external measures, but they nonetheless take great joy in being generous, and other people may have an enormous amount more by external measures, but not internally to seem to ever have the feeling of even having enough. And it is so hard in those circumstances to be able to give. So some sense of inner abundance is said to be the wellspring out of which we can offer or care. And so that translates into like this generosity of the spirit. If you feel depleted, overcome, bereft, you have no wherewithal, there's nothing happening inside, it is awfully hard to feel generous towards someone else or even to pay much attention to them. Isn't it? It's like, go away. Whereas if we can touch back into the sense of inner abundance or sufficiency, then it's not so hard to listen to somebody, to thank them, to really look at them, to be present, to let go of our concepts and our assumptions and really be much more present. So we start with the offering of loving kindness to ourselves. It's also said that the trajectory of practice in loving kindness meditation is to do it in the easiest way possible. And so that's the underlying principle. Therefore, if it's really, really hard to offer loving kindness to yourself, then according to that principle, we just say, switch the order. It's not like remedial work. It's not like you're doing anything wrong. It's actually adhering to what is the basic principle of the practice, and that takes some reminding. Oneself. So usually when I talk about it in the classical order, knowing that there will be probably many people in any given room who want to ultimately, based on that principle, do it somewhat differently, and that's fine. So we start with ourselves. The next category of being, and I don't mean this for all for one session, the next category of being we offer loving kindness to is a benefactor. This is someone who's helped us. Maybe they've helped us directly, or maybe we've never met them, but they've inspired us from afar. This being, the Buddhist texts say this is the one who, when we think about them, we smile. It's like an embodiment of love for us. Who has reminded us of the power of love? It could be an adult, it could be a child, it could be a pet. When I was first asking for stories for the book Real Love or whatever it's going to be called, somebody told me this story. We were in a gathering, you know, and he said, talked about his dog. And he said, most people think a good relationship is 50-50. Well, my dog and I, we're 100-100. I thought, that's so beautiful. You know, so it's almost like, who lifts our spirits? Who has a smile? And if there's someone, there's not always someone who comes to mind, but if there's someone, we offer loving kindness to them. The next category is a friend. And there are various ways of choosing a friend. The category after that, I think, is, for me, it's the most interesting of all, and that's a neutral person, somebody we don't strongly like or dislike. I find it interesting because I think it exemplifies the way this practice works, which is not trying to force yourself to feel something or make up a story about somebody, but it's the fact that when we pay full attention to someone, instead of ignoring them, something happens. And there is a sense of connection. Somebody asked me, I was teaching the other night in New York, and somebody said something like, when you feel really lonely, how do you create a sense of connection? And I said, I think the connection is there. I think that's the reality. But we don't tend to pay attention in a way that allows it, you know, that lets it in. But you don't have to make connection. I think that's reality. And we have to really open to it. So I really love the neutral person. Neutral person is someone you don't strongly like or dislike. You're just kind of neutral. In an intensive retreat setting, we usually say, maybe choose someone who's here, because you'll run into them now and then, and you'll get to gauge how your feeling about them is evolving, or your sense of connection is evolving. And if you're not in a retreat, we say, well, maybe choose someone in your life that plays some kind of role or function, because you'll get to see them now and then, and just watch what happens. So when you're offering loving kindness to a neutral person, you may not even know their name, but you're calling them to mind, and you're wishing them well. So that means you're paying attention to them. So I don't know how many of you have seen the animations that are on my website from the site happify.com. So I might have talked about this when I was last year in D.C. So I went into a studio, a recording studio, and I just told a couple of stories. And this website, happify.com, made them into animations. So the first one was basically the story, which I'm about to tell you, and then a lot of stuff that I said earlier, that compassion can be trained. It depends on how we pay attention. They're only like 3 minutes or something like that. So the story that's in the first animation, which is like one of the cutest things in the world, I think, because every character in there is a dog. So you see this dog's mouth moving and my voice is coming out of it. It's like really cute. Even though I live in Massachusetts, I have long had a sublet apartment in New York City, different apartments at different times. And so the story happened, I think, 2 apartments ago. When a writer friend of mine was also living in that neighborhood, and he showed me a copy of his manuscript before it was going to print. So he tells a story in the manuscript about often going into the store, a particular corner grocery store, and often seeing the same woman working behind the counter, and really not having much sense of her at all, except maybe she was like a little bit unhappy or a little bit sullen or something, but really vague. Because he said, I really don't pay any attention to her. for all I realize that she's a living, breathing human being and wants to be happy, just as I do, she might as well be a cash register with arms. And he was so shocked at himself that he decided he was going to go into the store and pay absolute, complete attention to her. So he did that, and he's writing on this. He said, the first thing he noticed was that she was singing along to the song on the radio, and that she had an exquisitely beautiful voice. And he said to her, "Wow, you have a really beautiful voice." And he wrote, she just lit up, and she gave me this big, beautiful smile. So I read that, and I thought, wow, I go into that same store all the time, too, and I hardly notice her either. I don't really have much of a sense of her. So I thought, well, it's too weird to go in there and say, I read you have a really beautiful voice. It's totally like paranoia making, but I could go in there and say, I heard you had a really beautiful voice, because that's the kind of thing that might come up in conversation, right? So I thought, okay, I'm going to go in there, and I'm going to say, I heard you had a really beautiful voice, and she's going to light up and just give me this big radiant smile. I'm going to make her so happy. So I went into the store, and the first thing I noticed was that she already looked perfectly happy. And I thought, oh. And I realized how much of her I also missed from just not paying attention. Right? So this is all coming in as dog's mouth. Everyone's a dog. It's really cute. But that's the point, right? Not that you are forcing yourself to feel something you don't feel, or you're trying to manufacture something, but when you actually pay attention to someone, even without getting their story, something happens. Because, in fact, the truth of our lives is that our lives have something to do with one another, that we are all linked. And the thing that happens, that kind of connection, is what we would call love. It doesn't mean you like somebody. It doesn't mean you're going to bring them home. But there is that real sensibility that our lives are intertwined, that everybody counts. Everybody matters. We are reflecting something deep between us. So that's why I love the part. Some people find it really boring, and it is pretty boring in the beginning. I mean, you don't really know anything about this person. But over time, it's kind of amazing to see what happens. I chose, because I was doing this in Burma in the context of intensive retreat, I chose another meditator there, a woman who was from somewhere in South America. I don't really actually even know where. As my neutral person. And this is another point about this kind of practice. You may not feel much in the actual period of practice, whether it's every day or intensive retreat like that, but the changes you will find in your actual life, which is where they really count, right? So a lot of people get very frustrated because they say, oh, I did this practice, nothing happened. But really, a lot is happening, and that will show itself where it counts, how you speak to yourself, how you meet a stranger, how you meet someone you had a whole bunch of assumptions about. I often tell this story, but I was taken out to lunch in New York by someone who was a student of mine. It was like kind of like a confessional lunch. He started out by saying, I just have to confess something. So I said, oh, what? He said, I've been doing loving kindness practice now every day for about 3 years, whether I'm on retreat or I'm just sitting at home. And he said, I'd have to say that my experience formally sitting is not that different now from what it was 3 years ago. But I'm like a completely different person. He said, I'm different with myself. I'm different with my family. I'm different ethically. I'm different in my community. And then he looked at me and he said, is that enough? And I said, yeah, I kind of think it's enough, you know? But I know we fixate on the meditative experience. And, you know, I'm not like filled with this blissful whatever, you know, it doesn't matter, truly. Okay, so we have the neutral person, and I was saying I chose this woman, and then she left Burma, you know, and I was just continuing on my practice. So maybe a month later, I left Burma, and I was in Bangkok getting ready to fly back to the States, and I was walking down the streets, and there she was. And it was like I was filled with the most enormous love for her. And I just like threw my arms around her. I don't know what she thought, but you know, it was just like, it was so real. It was like, wow, there you are, my neutral person. Wow. So whether it's your dry, I mean, you don't have to hug everybody really, but you know, whether it's your dry cleaner or grocery store person or whatever, you will see over time there actually is something different. Look at that difference. It's a very important difference. And then the next category in kind of formal loving kindness practice after ourselves, a benefactor, friend, a neutral person is a difficult person. And here we come back to that principle of doing it in the easiest way possible. The recommendation is that you not start with the most impossible person. The person who has hurt you so badly is just about unthinkable, or has behaved in your eyes so badly on the world stage that, I mean, you just can't, you know? But to start with somebody that you're a little bit annoyed with and slowly make your way over time. And again, this is a little bit like what I was saying earlier, sitting with pain. It's not wrong. So just like go for the pain, but you might as well build in balance all along the way. It's a very similar thing. It's not wrong to want to just explore like this extremely difficult person. It's just easier if you do certain building blocks along the way. So the building blocks are like an embodied understanding of what it means to have loving kindness and compassion for yourself, as well as someone else. What it means to have compassion for someone and know it is absolutely wrong to give in and you're not going to do it. What it means to have compassion for someone and to realize I can't fix it. It's not up to me. So it's not like we have all the answers and it's not like we try to figure things out, but we go through enough experiences that we have kind of a growing body of understanding. So that even if you don't have the words for it, when you are then grappling with offering loving kindness to a more difficult person, you've got all that resource also. So it's almost like it's an invitation for once in our lives to do things in the easiest way possible rather than the hardest way possible, which is not that easy for us, generally speaking. But that's why it is suggested that we not start with this overwhelmingly difficult person, but of course it's always up to you what you do. If it, even a mildly difficult person is too difficult, don't worry about it. You can always go back to offering loving kindness to yourself. It's never the wrong thing to do. And then from there, we offer loving kindness to all beings everywhere, to all of life. So in any single session of sitting, you don't try to do it all. That's just too much. Usually we say, of course, it depends on how much time you have, but usually we say maybe start with yourself and end with all beings. And maybe you have time for one other person in the middle. Maybe you have a friend who's having surgery and you want to be sure to include them. Or you have a friend who's getting a big award today. You want to be sure to include them, or your dry cleaner is your neutral person. You're going to the dry cleaner today. You want to be sure to include them, or whatever it might be. So it's really up to you, but there's a lot of possibility and creativity in that middle portion. There's also ways of doing the practice, which is what we're going to actually start with, which is a walking meditation, where you're not necessarily using those categories, but it's the same sense of unfolding, of having loving kindness for yourself as a kind of base and opening to say who comes by, something like that. In the end, loving kindness can be like mindfulness, something that you can very privately interject into any encounter. People tell me, for example, in terms of big meetings at work, people tell me, one woman told me she looks at everyone one by one and silently thinks, oh, you want to be happy too. You want to be happy too. You want to be happy too. Because this is the belief within Buddhist teachings that everybody wants to be happy. And it's because of the force of ignorance that we make so many mistakes and can cause so much suffering for ourselves and for others. But everybody really wants to be happy. Not in a superficial sense either. We want a sense of belonging. We want some sense of having a home somewhere in this life. And we get so confused about where that's to be found that we can create sometimes tremendous suffering. But bottom line, that urge is there. So where people tell me they will do a few minutes of silent loving kindness in the beginning of a meeting, just including everyone sitting around that table, just to see if the tenor of the conversation will be affected. Certainly people tell me, and I do this a lot myself, when I don't know what else to do. You know, I don't have a clear sense of what should I say, or where might I help, or, you know, I'm completely confounded. There I am, you know, I can connect energetically, at least, through doing loving kindness. There is a loving kindness walking practice, and we're going to start with that, and then do some sitting, and then just talk about love, because it's so much fun. Yeah?
Does the person for sure have to be alive?
Okay, does the person have to be alive? No. In the very classical teachings, we are encouraged to do loving kindness practice. It's kind of a dual track that's being developed, two things at the same time. One is a sense of loving kindness, and one is the power of concentration, because it is a concentration exercise. And so it says somewhere in there that if the recipient of your loving kindness is no longer alive, it would be more difficult to develop like these very deep kinds of altered states of consciousness born of concentration. Whether that's true or not, I have no idea. Why it would make a difference, I have no idea. But I also don't know people really who practice loving kindness for that. So for the sake of the loving kindness itself, no, it doesn't make a difference. Because loving kindness is done verbally, not out loud, but through the silent repetition of certain phrases, you may find that the particular phrases you're using need to alter. For someone who's no longer alive, phrases are, well, you may not. Phrases are commonly things like, beginning with yourself, may I be safe, be happy, be healthy, live with ease. Live with ease means things of day-to-day life, like family or livelihood. May it not be such a struggle, may I live with ease. The phrases I used in Burma when I first went were, may I, you know, ultimately, may you, may I be free from danger, may I be free from mental suffering, may I be free from physical suffering, may I have ease of well-being, or may I live with ease. And I will say I had a tremendous transforming time in that period. And when I came back in 1985 and I started teaching loving kindness in this country, I taught in a variety of places, like the California joke. I taught in a variety of places on the East Coast and it was all fine. And then I went to California and I was leading a retreat. And I led the first sitting and I was always suggesting my phrases from Burma because it had been so powerful for me. And I, we sat and I rang the bell, and I looked up and there was a line of people waiting to complain to me that stretched out probably that back door. And everyone was saying, I don't feel comfortable saying danger, 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 danger. I don't want to say suffering, 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 even though it's free of suffering. So we tended to change the words to be more like, may I be safe, be happy, be healthy, live with ease. I honestly don't think it matters, but I also know it's not good to struggle with the word. So in the context of a very traditional culture like Burma, really believes in rebirth, you may be offering loving kindness using those words to someone who's died, because they believe they're alive somewhere. And they also believe that the strongest force that connects us beyond the body, beyond time, beyond space, is our own good-heartedness. So there are certain things like sharing merit that are done with someone who's died as a form of loving kindness. But, you know, that is a belief system. And so in that belief system, it actually makes some sense to say, may you be happy, may you be healthy, because they believe they're somewhere. If you don't have that belief system, it makes no sense. It's almost like it's an act of remembrance, it's an act of gratitude. And so you might just change the words in some way to suit that, you know, to whatever seems right. It's fine to change the words anyway, but it's good to settle on basically a set of phrases you're going to use. Otherwise, given just the conditioned nature of our attention, you can try to change the words every 10 seconds. What about you? You know, and it's going to be, you're going to lose the force of the concentration. So we say try to choose phrases that are general enough, they're big enough. You can basically offer them to yourself and to others and to all, with the exceptions of the times that, you know, somebody comes to mind and it just feels like they need a different set of phrases, but you don't want to be constantly kind of thinking, like, what about you? Okay, so walking meditation. Sunday we came out. There are some similarities and some differences in mindfulness walking and loving kindness walking. You don't have to slow down at all. You might slow down just because of the space consideration somewhere, but you don't have to. You can just do this at a totally normal pace. You're not resting your attention in the sensations of movement. You're resting your attention in the silent repetition of phrases. And again, it needs to be a very light awareness. You're not trying to like hunker down and cut off everything else. You just have this touchstone as you walk along. And there are many ways of doing this. I usually suggest the way I like the best, which is not going through all those categories in walking, but to generally speaking have a baseline of loving kindness for myself. And admit four phrases may be too many in walking. So often I'll be walking and I'll just be silently repeating, may I be happy, be peaceful. Be happy, be peaceful. And then when someone comes strongly into my consciousness, I include them. I hear a dog. I hear a bird. See a person walking by. Or even someone from home just like arrives with a bag. It's like, oh, be happy. And then I go back to the phrases for myself. I like doing it that way because it gives me a little more structure and containment. There's a lot of life out there and really bounce around, but having that resting place works for me. And then playing also is interesting and fun because maybe you're afraid of dogs and you hear a dog. Or whatever it might be. One of the things I love, I do this really all the time walking down the streets of New York, or I try to at any rate. And one of the things I really enjoy is that all the same judgments arrive, but they're kind of capped with some loving kindness, like, that's the wrong jacket for this season. I'll be happy. Whatever. Subways are also very interesting. So let me just reiterate, it's the silent repetition of these phrases. It's a very light awareness, and it's the silent repetition. Once I was teaching a non-residential retreat in Berkeley, and either I had not been clear enough or someone got confused, and they said, they went out, we did our walking meditation on the streets, and they came back and they said, well, I saw this group of people on the street corner and I mustered up all my courage. And I went up to them and I said, may you be happy. And I thought, oh, at least it's Berkeley. You know, like, it was okay here, but not everywhere. So have fun, play, you know. See what happens as you just notice one another with a little more goodwill than maybe one's ordinary condition.